Good morning, Park Church. This morning's scripture is from 2 Peter. It's 1 Peter chapter 2, and it's verses 4 through 12. If you don't have a Bible with you this morning, please use one of the Bibles in the pews. And if you are using one of those, you'll be on 1014 is the page number. And if you don't have one of those, if you don't have a Bible at home, please take that one with you. So 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 12. As you come to him, a living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house, to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For it stands in Scripture, "Behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone chosen and precious, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame. So the honor is for you who believe, but for those who do not believe, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. They stumble because they disobey the word, as they were destined to do. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." This is the word of the Lord.
Is everyone doing all right? I have a quick announcement, and then a short introduction, and then a sermon. Are you ready? First, the announcement. If you missed men's or women's boot camp, which started on Thursday, it's totally okay. You're forgiven. You're loved. You're accepted by God because of what Jesus has done, not because you showed up or failed to show up on Thursday. But here's the thing. You have to show up this Thursday. And so if you're a guy, 6 a.m. If you're a female, 7 p.m., we will be downstairs. If you're going to look at me and go, I don't have a book, that's totally fine. We have a whole bunch of books right over there on the bookshelf. And you say, well, I don't even know what to do. I wasn't there. I didn't get the card. I didn't get what I was supposed to read. We have cards right over there. It's amazing. So I'm going to encourage you immediately after the service, go grab a book, go grab a card. If for whatever reason you can't make it on Thursdays, totally understandable. I would still encourage you to read, but it's not totally understandable. It's just, it might be understandable. And so I encourage you to join up with us this Thursday if you had to miss this week. And if you can't come to men's or women's boot camp, I want to encourage you to read the book with us as we're going along. We'll have the cards every week. We'll post it online. We'll have them here on Sundays, and you can keep up with us as we work our way through John Owen's Mortification of Sin. Today we kick off a series on the local church. We're going to take 7 weeks and do something a little bit different. Usually here, what we like to do is we take books of the Bible, and we work straight through it. So we just finished John, the Gospel of John, last week. We started that in August. We ran from August up until last week, just working our way verse by verse by verse through books of the Bible. We love to do that primarily because it forces you to deal with texts that you wouldn't necessarily choose to deal with. There's all kinds of places in the Bible which, just left to our own decisions, man, we would just skip over them. But what we're going to do for the next 7 weeks, and then we'll jump into the Psalms for the summer, is we're going to take 7 weeks and ask the question, what is the local church? And I want to give you a little bit of background as we step into it this morning. Originally slotted for this few weeks after Easter, we were going to take some time, and as a church body, look at what the Bible has to say about money. We'd gotten together with the elders. We were planning kind of what would these few weeks look like. You look in the Bible, and there's all kinds of things to be said about money. What do we do with the blessings that God has given us, with the resources God has given us? How do we wield them for the good of our city? How do we wield them for the good of the world? How do we wield them together as a community in the church? One of our elders in this meeting, as we're planning where we're going, had this moment of brilliance and said, I wonder I wonder if now is the time to talk about money, if we don't first need to establish for our body, what does it mean to be the church? Because if at the end, one of the things that we're going to do in this series is ask people to give and to tithe to the local church, how are we going to ask them to do that if we haven't first held up from the scriptures what the local church actually is? And as we begin to pray about it and think about just where we are as a church body, with the reality that most of you honestly have come to Park Church in the last 10 months, more than half of you have entered into this place in that short span of time. We wanted to take these 7 weeks and just ask the question, what is this church? What does it mean to belong to it, to be a part of it? And so we're going to take the scriptures over the next few weeks and talk about the different ways that the church defines the church and sends the church and identifies the church in the plan of God and the purposes of God. So that's why we're going to do this for the next 7 weeks. Let me pray and we'll get started. Father, I don't want to treat lightly the visceral reaction that some of us have when we hear the word institution, or we think about even the phrase local church. Whether it's people who've grown up in churches where they were hurt, or they saw pettiness elevated, or whether it's just popular notions about what local churches are in terms of just another business peddling Christianity or peddling a religion. I don't want to treat those things lightly. And so God, I ask now as we step into 1 Peter 2, we step into this vista of describing what this room represents in your purposes and your plans. God, I pray and acknowledge I desperately need your help. That your Spirit would come and help us to see again. Your Spirit would come and help us to hear these words and believe them, and as a result of it, Father, I pray that we would fall in love again with the bride of Jesus. And some of us for the very first time would see her in her splendor, in her beauty, in the purity that you promise for her, no matter what our experiences or lack of experiences might tell us. So Spirit, come, help us to fall in love with the bride of Jesus. In your name we pray. Amen. I met my wife one summer at a popular camp in Missouri. She was a camper and I was a counselor. It was very, very holy and good. And so we met that summer, became friends, we kept in touch. Soon thereafter, just a few months later, she was headed to South Carolina for college. I was headed back to Chicago for college, and we kept in touch and began to date. Over the course of that long-distance relationship, we would occasionally fly in to one another's cities and spend a weekend together, and we would often have formal dinners. We would go play Frisbee in the park. I would meet all of her friends. She would meet all of my friends, and it was this beautiful kind of flourishing relationship. That summer, we spent the summer together, running a youth group in a small church in St. Louis, and it was a blast. It was the first time we were actually in the same city for longer than 3 or 4 days after camp. At the end of that time, we went back to our separate cities, but over the course of those 18 months, which led up to our finally getting married, I saw her dressed formally. I saw her at a park playing Frisbee. We played sports together. We had fun together. We played tennis together, which I still argue that I beat her significantly at tennis. She argues against it, at any rate, who can keep score at tennis anyway? It's weird. 15, 30, whatever. At any rate, I saw her and found her compelling and beautiful. I fell in love with this woman. I decided over the course of that time, hey, this is the woman I want to give my life to. I want to marry one day. And then the day of our wedding arrived, and prior to that wedding, we decided that we were going to do things a little bit differently, and we wanted to have pictures taken prior to the ceremony so people wouldn't have to wait for us after the ceremony. And so we arranged that prior to the wedding, we were going to have this moment where I was going to be in the sanctuary waiting for her, and she was going to come, and we were going to see each other, and we were going to hug, and then take some pictures at that point, and kind of have this special moment prior to the ceremony where I was going to get to see my wife on our wedding day just before our wedding, which I don't necessarily recommend or not recommend, but who cares? At any rate, it was this moment, right? So the moment came. I go into the sanctuary. I'm standing up front waiting for her. And they throw open the doors. And what happened next, I struggle to explain to you without it making being just complete cheeseball. All right? But I don't know how else to do it. I began to cry, which everyone cries at their wedding, right? And you always make fun of the people who cry at their wedding, but I began to cry. I mean, I began to cry not because I was seeing my wife, and she just happened to look kind of, she usually looks beautiful, but on this particular moment, she looks really beautiful. It was as though I was seeing her for the very first time. To see her open, to see those doors opened and her in this white dress. It was like the very first time I'd ever laid eyes on her. Completely different than the first time I laid eyes on her. I mean, she was radiant with beauty. I mean, as she began to walk down the aisle, I started getting very fidgety. I'm crying. I'm like, I don't know what to do. She gets so close. Can I touch her? Can I hold her? I mean, what do you do with this beautiful picture of glory and radiance and beauty and the fact that in just a few short minutes, she will be my wife forever and ever and ever, and I can barely look at her right now. This is the kind of experience that Peter wants us to have as he begins to describe for us, not simply our wives or our husbands, although I've never heard one wife ever describe the moment she saw her husband on her wedding day. Not just beholding my wife on my wedding day, but seeing the bride prepared for Jesus himself. My prayer for this whole series, but particularly my prayer for us today, is that it would be as though the doors are thrown open and we behold again, for the very first time, the church, the bride of Jesus. That we would see her in her radiance and in her beauty. That we'd begin to fidget a little bit and not know quite what to do with her as she steps towards us. I mean, this is what Peter sets out for us. My hope. Many of you have been around this woman your entire lives. Many of you have mistreated this woman your entire lives. Many of you have wrongly thought about who she is and that she's an option. She's somebody to visit whenever you have the need to visit her. But my prayer and my hope is that as Peter begins to describe for us who she actually is, what it is actually that gathers in this room Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, you'd fall in love. That you'd see it not just as a cheeseball description of a man seeing his wife on his wedding day, but you'd see this as the bride of Jesus, the one that he cleanses with his own blood, that he lays down his life to purchase, that she might be his. So let's look at this text again in 1 Peter chapter 2. And I want us to look particularly at where Peter begins, because where Peter begins is where all descriptions of what the local church is and what the local church should be, this is where they all have to begin. And so in verse 4, he says, "As you come to him, a living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious." I want you to notice, too, from the mention it here in a minute, that in verse 3, he talks again that we should long for this milk, we should long for this word of the gospel, this word that declares to us who Jesus is, like we long for spiritual milk. And particularly in verse 3, he says that we have tasted that this Lord, this Jesus, is good. Here's where our understanding, our doctrine of the local church begins. It begins with a confession, not simply that Jesus is true, not simply that all the theological things that we're supposed to line up and get right with who Jesus is, that those things are true, as though what it takes to be a Christian, what it takes to be the church, is you take the doctrinal test, you check it off the list, and you get things right. You say, yeah, I can say that those things are true about Jesus. And no, it goes far beyond that. The beginning of our understanding of what the local church is we are a community that have come to Jesus, and we count him as precious. Not simply true, but desirable. That we long for him, that we desire to be near him. Over the coming weeks, we're going to talk about what makes a church. How should the leadership of a church be structured? What should the worship of the church look like? We're going to talk about all kinds of different marks of what the local church is and what they should do. But here's where I want us, I desperately need for us to begin. This is where Peter begins. The church is first marked out as a people who, when we look to Jesus, we don't see a stumbling block. We don't see something offensive. We see something desirable, desirable that we might lay down our lives to have him, to taste him, to be near to him, to long for him. That the church, this bride, who are to look to our husband, I want nothing more than to be with him forever and ever and ever. Peter describes two different reactions to Jesus. One accords with how God looks upon his son. He sees his son as chosen. He sees his son as precious. But this son, this Jesus, is also rejected by men. And he's rejected for two reasons that Peter outlines here. He says in verse 8, as he quotes another Old Testament text, that this stone, this Jesus, this precious stone, is a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. That people see the person of Jesus, they hear the claims of Jesus, and they see that the work Jesus has done in dying in our place, and they don't love him, they don't count him as precious and desirable, but they stumble and they're offended by him. They don't want anything to do with him. So this distinguishes the church from these men. We look to Jesus, we hear his story, but we hear the story particularly of the gospel, that he lives the life we couldn't live, he dies the death we deserve to die, that he was raised again on the third day, conquering sin and death. We see this man, this God, this king, and we long for him. We love him. But we don't simply cognitively acknowledge his truthfulness. We love him. Now, this people who come to him, now we come to him as we come to a stone, which is just an interesting choice of words that Peter uses. It's actually a metaphor that's used throughout the New Testament to describe who Jesus is. He's described here as a living stone, particularly, if you look, jump down to verse 7, a particular kind of stone, a cornerstone. Now, I don't know how many of you do a whole lot of stone masonry. I don't do any. In the first century, if you went to build a stone house today, if you're going to build a stone house and you've got this big idea, you're going to go out to the mountains and just start stacking stones and build a house, whatever you set apart as the cornerstone is very, very important. You've got to cut it just right. It's got to be cut in such a way that the weight of the house can fall and lean onto this particular cornerstone. See, the cornerstone supports the weight. It supports the structure of the entire house. And so this is why even the text describes this Jesus as a stone that God has counted as precious and chosen. If you were a stonemason setting out to build a temple or a large house, you would look for a precious stone that you would choose. Once you chose it, you would set it, and everything else would be lined out from this stone and the way you cut the angles in this stone. But as we step into this second piece, you've got to see it. He says, verse 5, as we've come to him in verse 4. Verse 5, he says, you yourselves, us, the local church, this body of people who've seen him as precious and chosen, like God does. And so we come to him like living stones are being built up as a spiritual house or a house of the Spirit to be a holy priesthood. So he says that we come to Jesus. As we come to Jesus, in coming to him, here's what Jesus does. He knits us together, stacks us together, stone upon stone upon stone, stone leaning against stone, stone standing by stone, of this structure that's built up, that's to be a house of the Spirit, or a dwelling place where God's Spirit lives. Or another way to describe that is a temple of God, the place where God is to be known and seen and experienced. Now, don't miss the connection here. He says to come to Jesus is to be built together into a house. The metaphor falls apart completely, if you think of yourself as a temple, you think of yourself as the dwelling place of God, I mean, the metaphor doesn't work. The whole idea, the whole picture that Peter is painting is that God is building something, and that he's taking you and me as individual stones who are coming to Jesus, and as we're brought to Jesus, we're connected to one another, and we're built up into a house that leans on one another, a house that irritates one another. A house where God's presence dwells. Let me make it a little more explicit for you. The goal of the gospel is the building of the church. We've grown fond of thinking about our relationship with God and what the gospel does to us in primarily individualistic tones and terms. I meant terms, not tones. And I tried to pass it off on you like I meant to do that. But what would that word even mean there? In primarily individualistic terms. So it's, I come to Jesus, I delight in Jesus, I love Jesus, I'm forgiven by Jesus, now I have a relationship with God through Jesus, and that's me. And then what that does is when you come to gather with the church, like we're doing right now, you begin to think of this as merely a collection of people who all, because of Jesus, have a relationship with God, have been forgiven by God, and then we all gather together, we hear a sermon, we listen to some music, and then we all leave, but there's no sense that we belong together. There's no sense that we have responsibility for this institution, this community, this body called the church. And that makes nonsense out of Peter's argument here. Peter's point is that we come to Jesus, and it says we come to Jesus. If you come to Jesus, you're being built together as a house. Now, let me step on to this little piece as well. Some of us think that whenever we see the word church, wherever we see these kinds of concepts of body or temple or building, what we tend to primarily think of is church with a big C, the whole universal church thing. So I'm connected with the church, which means I'm connected to every believer everywhere. And that, as far as it goes, is true. But I want to say something to you. This is not meant to be simply an idea in your head that somehow loosely you have some connection to the reality of believers everywhere always. No, this is meant to be felt, to be expressed, to be seen, to be pointed at. God did not give Peter these words to describe an idea, but to describe the lived reality of this particular local church. That where we are right now, what we are as a church called Park Church is not just a collection of individuals who happen to show up to this particular building to get our religious fries on a Sunday morning. No, this is a house built by God. You and I are stones built upon one another in such a way that God himself makes his home here. That his spirit dwells here with us as he knits us together in this way. I had lunch with a pastor a few months ago, and it was a very, very irritating lunch. Beware, lunches with pastors could be irritating, particularly this one. And as we're sitting there talking, he's asking about Park Church, and he heard some things about us, and he said this phrase. He said, well, it looks like you guys are the next big thing. He'd been in our city for a while, and his church has been through kind of ebbs and flows of growth and decline and growth and decline. And I was infuriated when he said that. And here's why. I want to say this with a smile on my face, and with joy and with a little bit of anger. We are not a thing. This is not just happened to be the new show in town that Christians show up for, and then in a few years there'll be a new thing, and you go to that thing, and then you go to another thing. And if your hobby is to find the next trendy church that you can go to and show up and listen to music and listen to sermons, you have a really stupid hobby. Like, there's way better hobby. You live in freaking Denver. Like, go ski. Like, trade in your hobby for something else. This thing that God is building, first, it's God is building a temple, a place where he might dwell, where his presence would be known. And you, all of you, are stones that he is using to build this house, which means you bear responsibility for one another, and there are others who bear responsibility for you. You have an obligation to care for, to love, to bear the weight of your brothers and sisters who sit around you, the other stones who sit around you, just as they have an obligation, a calling, a responsibility before God to bear up underneath you. And who knows if you're not the weightier stone. This is what God's doing. Not a thing. Not a trendy little place to show up on Sundays. He is building a house for himself in our city. A place where he can be known and he can be seen. But see where he goes next. He says he's building up as a spiritual house, as a temple, to be a holy priesthood. It's an interesting shift there. He's been describing a temple. Who works in the temples but the priests? To be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God. He's going to go on later in just a minute. He's going to describe us again as a royal priesthood when he begins to do this kind of long litany, this list of descriptions of what we are, what this church is. But I want to think for a moment about this notion, this claim that we are a holy priesthood, that he's knit us together to be a holy priesthood. We actually had a priest show up here this morning, and my daughter saw him, and then we were down in my office, and she said, Dad's a priest, and she kind of made fun of me a little bit for being a priest. And I said, no, I'm not a priest. And then she said, well, who is a priest? And I said, you're a priest. And I said, it was kind of fit perfectly. And she looked at me very, very confused. What do you mean, Daddy? I'm not a priest. You're a priest. And then we went back and forth, had an argument, and it turned. I like to join my children in their childrenness. But think about this for a moment. What does a priest do? A priest does a handful of things. One, he stands before God and represents the people, and he stands before the people and he represents God. What Peter's arguing here in calling us a holy temple and by calling us a priesthood is to say, hey, I'm not the priest here. We are the priest. We represent God to the world. We represent God to our city. The calling of Park Church Denver is to be knit together in such a way that we're set apart in our city, that we bear witness to our city of who God is and what God has done in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. That's not my job. That's our job. That's not my vocation. That's our vocation. That's what our life together is meant to do in this city. But also think about what else priests do. Well, one of priests' primary jobs is to take the mundane, to take shovels that they're going to use to shovel ash and set them apart as holy. To take sacrifices and see them set apart as holy. That this is the other thing that we're called to do in our life. Not primarily as vocational ministers or pastors like me, but as people who go and serve coffee to their neighbors, as those who do barbecues in their backyard, invite their neighbors into it, as those who are married and have kids, as those who just live in neighborhoods and do jobs and work as bankers and work as bike shop salespeople and work in all kinds of different industries. We take all of those things and we set them apart as holy, as things that belong to God, as places where the goodness and the glory of God would be seen. This is what God is doing as we come to Jesus. Not giving you a nice individual existential experience of the glory of Christ, but knitting you together with the weirdo sitting next to you today. Knitting you together with them. That together we might be built up into this house where God himself dwells. Where he declares his person to the world, who he is and what he's like. Where he takes all of creation, all the jobs represented in this room, all the relationships represented in this room, and he gives them purpose. And he sets them apart for his own name and makes them all of them holy, belonging to him. And if you think of this text, you think of these works merely as the things that you do as an individual Christian, you'll miss Peter's point. This is who the local church is. This is what Park Church is in the plans of God. not a thing, not a show, a temple, a gathering of priests working together to declare the person of God to our world and to see all things set apart and made holy. Now listen to this description. This is an amazing description, starting in verse 9. He says, but you collectively, you are a chosen race. Think about that for a moment. This is a declaration that the God of the universe has chosen you. It's filled up with the language of adoption. That God looked out on the world and he said, this people belong to me. And these people I set my love on. These people I will be a father to. These people I choose, I love, I set my affections on. But then keep going. That we are a royal priesthood. We just talked about that. A holy nation. Now this word nation, it doesn't mean kind of what it means in our day. For us, it means kind of primarily like these political, economic boundary markers around certain geographical spaces. That's not what it means when Peter's using this word nation. It means a family, a large extended family with a common past and a common history, a common story and common hopes. That if you were a Jew in exile, if you were a member of the Jewish nation in exile, you would gather together in Rome to sing the songs of your people, to sing the songs of your nation, to tell stories of what God had done in the past, anticipating what God would one day in the future. This is how he describes what Park Church Denver is to be, a nation, a tribe, a family, set apart, singing the songs of the homeland, declaring and longing for the day when God would restore us and bring us into our inheritance. And keep going. A people for his own possession. Do you know that God owns us? It may sound weird to your ears, right? But he owns us as his people. He's deeply concerned with how it goes for us. We belong to him. That you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. That we represent a people who once were in darkness, who once were blind, but have been brought into his light. That we might see all that is his, all that he has created, and know him as light. We don't wander in the darkness anymore, but know the light that he has called us into. And then verse 10, once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Now here's where we might start running into some trouble. You see, we live in a city called Denver. If you didn't know that, you've got some stuff you should work out. We live in a city called Denver. Now the interesting thing about our city is very few people who live in Denver are from Denver. Now inevitably somebody's going to come up to me after the service and tell me they're from Denver. That's great. We're proud of you. We love you. But here's the reality. Most of you aren't from here. In fact, most of us, myself included, most of us walked away from family, walked away from friends, we walked away from churches, we walked away from careers, we walked away from everything we'd ever known to move to a place so we could go mountain biking. And the mountain biking part's not true about me, obviously. But or left all of those things, left everything we knew so we could go ski. Or we could see mountains sometimes. In other words, we are the kinds of people who live in our city. We're the kinds of people who don't want to be bound to anything or anyone. We don't have any sort of institutional allegiances. We don't define ourselves in terms of our family or in terms of any particular church. We tend to think of ourselves primarily as individuals making individual choices, kind of redefining our own lives, not in course of anything that's come before, not in terms of any institution, not in terms of anything except for what we want or desire. Now, here's a little clue. That's destroying everything. Marriages end all the time because people are deciding, hey, this doesn't make me happy anymore. I'm not bound to the institution of marriage. I'm not bound to this other person. I'm not happy anymore, so I'm going to leave and go find myself, define myself, make myself happy. If we do it with marriages, we'll do it with everything else, including the church. We just want to go where we can be happy, which fits us. How do we want to define ourselves? But that's precisely the curse that Peter is declaring the good news. It's not our story anymore. And so when we hear this, that there can be a real dissonance in our own soul and our own minds as we hear about this. But you need to hear what Peter is holding up as glorious good news. You once weren't a people. You once were just an individual wanderer, not committed or belonging to any family, any tribe, any particular institution. But now you're God's people. And now you belong to his institution. Now you belong to his community. And now you belong to him. Now you're identified with a community, a tribe, a nation, a family called the church. Here's the clue. I don't know if you're a Christian or not a Christian, but there's a good chance that you've bought into the lie that your life is primarily what you make of it, not the people that you're bound to or the community that you're bound to. Can I just tell you, in the end, it's never going to work. That thing that you call freedom, it's darkness and it's wandering and it's slavery. The glorious good news of coming to Jesus is that you belong to a people now. And there's costs. Oh, there's costs. I mean, look down your row. There's somebody on that row that's going to be very costly to you. Marriage is costly. Being bound to people is costly. But according to the Bible, man, it's where life is to be found. According to the promise, the picture of this temple, this house of God's Spirit, it's where the very presence of God is to be found. Last one. That you are a people who once had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Consider with me a moment the glory of being a people who have received mercy. Who know that you deserve death, who know that you deserve suffering, who know that you deserve all kinds of pain, and you're given mercy instead. We live in a world that primarily thinks it doesn't need mercy. So as a result, a lot of us don't even know how to celebrate mercy. The gospel holds up the offensive reality that you and I deserved wrath and judgment and death, but we have not been given it. We've been given grace and kindness and adoption and the affections of God. And what does it mean to be a people, a community, marked as those who have received mercy? But what would the sounds of our songs be like? How would we treat those who offend us? What would our posture be to this world and to our city? If we truly believed, not just believed, but knew in the depths of our bones, we are people defined by the mercy of God being shown to us, would it not change everything? Now, I remember the very first time I saw this verse, like really saw it. I was 20 years old. Maybe I was 21. I was somewhere in my 20s. And I was sitting in class. And this guy had lectured for about 3 hours on this particular text and was talking again and again and again about how this different language is being used. And I remember distinctly sitting in the back of this classroom, just kind of being just a cynical, I don't want to cuss, but I won't, so I'll just say cynical guy in the back of a room. And all I'd known about the church is like, I'd seen pettiness taken to an all-time highs, turned into a professional sport. I'd seen self-righteousness and legalism just play out over and over and over again. I'd seen churches just blow through millions of dollars so they could have bowling alleys and basketball gyms, and because heaven forbid you would play basketball with anybody not in the church. I'd seen the worst of the worst of the worst. And so as this professor begins to stand up and explain to us, I mean, this image of the church as a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people set apart apart and washed by God. I mean, I remember sitting in the back of the room and slowly my cynicism began to erode as he held up again and again and again. Hey, I don't care what you've seen. I don't care what you've experienced. This is the declaration of God as to what the local church is. As we sit in this room, as we participate in this community week in and week out, whether that's in gospel communities or you're grabbing lunch with some friends from this church or whatever it is, here's the thing I want to hold up to you again and again and again. This is what God has declared to be true about this community. It's true. And some of you have been burned horribly in other churches. You've been treated reprehensibly. You've seen the pettiness. You've seen the silliness. I read an article this morning about a church that for Easter did a play on Star Wars and meshing the story of Jesus' resurrection with Star Wars. They had dancing stormtroopers. Next year. I'm kidding. You've seen the goofiness. You've seen the cynicism. You've seen the self-righteousness. You've seen all of it. But this is what the local church is. And I was thinking about that this week and considering we're actually going to sing together. If we have time, if I leave us time, we'll recite together the Nicene Creed. Let's think about the Nicene Creed and how as we walk through this creed, we confess things to be true that our eyes have not seen, but we confess them to be true anyway. Isn't it interesting? The Nicene Creed declares, I believe in one holy Catholic Church. Catholic there, not meaning Roman Catholic, but meaning church united. A church built upon the confession that Jesus is precious. Holy being a church, a people set apart, washed, and cleansed. The glory of what this text holds up to us is not that even at its best, it is not that you will live this experience day in and day out now. It's that God slowly but surely is building up a body for himself. Listen, I love Park Church. I love this body. You will be hurt here. You will. There are people here, and the crazy thing about people is that they still sin. They still act selfishly. It's weird. And as a result of that, your experience of this reality may feel broken. It may feel betrayed. But here's the glorious promise. This is who the church is. And we confess in hope that God is building his church here. And we confess in hope that this body is and will be holy, Catholic, and beautiful expression of the glory and presence of God in our city. You know what happens as I begin to confess things in hope and belief? I begin to see things like that face on Easter Sunday. I begin to sit at a table like this one and share a meal with brothers and sisters and not just have a meal and not just get irritated because whoever that guy is over there keeps talking about his work day, but I start to experience at this table the glory of what it means to have my life knit together with other brothers and sisters and see the very glory and majesty and power of God making himself known. This is what the church is. And as we close, he moves into this last paragraph, verse 11 and 12. He says, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable. The nations, this is Peter's way of talking about all those who do not believe in Jesus. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles, among the nations honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. that there's a purpose and a mission. We're not going to get into all the ways that he nuances that mission in this text. It's actually astounding. In a few weeks, we're going to talk about the mission of the church, and I'm going to come back to this text and talk in detail about the beautiful balance that Peter maintains and what the church, and how the church is meant to fulfill its mission in our city. But here's the thing I want you to see, is that there is a mission to our city. That our life together as this community, as this house, built together, leaning on one another, protecting one another, caring for one another, supporting one another, as we live this life in the midst of our city, that the end result that Peter says should take place is those who currently don't know Jesus, at some point, the day of Christ's arrival will be a day on which they give glory to God because they've seen the evidence of what he's like and who he is and what his mercy is in the life of the church. As we exist to exhibit to the world, to exhibit to our neighbors, to exhibit to our city, as a community, who God is and what he's like, and precisely the mercy that's been poured out on us in Jesus. He says that we've been called, that we've been made a people of his own possession, that we've been brought together as a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Why? That you may proclaim the excellencies of him who's called you out of darkness. You don't do that alone. You do that as a part of this beautiful body, this building, this temple, this thing called the church, made up of stones of which all of us are a part. Let's pray. And so, Father, I pray that by the Spirit, even now, you'd fling open the doors at the back of the sanctuary. Thank God that our eyes would see again the bride of Jesus. And not as this ornery woman that's annoyed us her whole life. And not as someone to treat lightly, not as someone to just come visit whenever we want to come visit, but God, that we would see her as holy, as radiant, as beautiful, as one who reflects your glory and your name and your mercy in the world. And God, that just on our wedding day, we see our brides and we recognize the reality that here's a woman I will lay my life down for. God, I pray that even today we would see your bride in this text and say, here is a woman I will lay down my life for. And in the midst of it, find ourselves knit together with brothers and sisters, set apart by you, declared holy by you, and given a mission by you. In your name we pray, amen. If you'll please stand with me.